Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the opening plenary session of Beyond Borders, SAA's 75th annual meeting. Please be seated. Please welcome California State Archivist Nancy Zemelman Lenoir and 2012 host chair Artist Cosville of the University of California, San Diego.
Good morning. On behalf of the host committee, welcome to San Diego. And now, Nancy Lenoir, California State Archivist, will read a proclamation.
California, the Golden State. Over 160 years ago, people came to California in search of gold and to fulfill golden dreams. As a result, the population grew and a new form of government was needed. The first legislature, meeting in San Jose, passed the first law in California that was signed by the governor on January 5, 1850. It was an act concerning the public archives, directing the California Secretary of State to safely keep and preserve the records of government in his office. As State Archivist of California, I want to welcome you to California and present a proclamation from the current Secretary of State, the Honorable Deborah Bowen, who continues to safely keep and preserve the records of state government in the California State Archives, a division of her office. This is relative to honoring the 76th annual meeting of the Society of American Archivists. Whereas since its founding in 1936, the Society of American Archivists, SAA, has been a keystone in promoting collaboration, cooperation, and innovation for the archival profession, and is the largest and oldest professional archival institution in North America. And whereas the SAA supports archivists in educational training, meetings, workshops, publications, and outreach activities, and works to assist archivists in establishing the best practices, standards, and professional codes of ethics for the archival field. And whereas the State Archives Division of the California Secretary of State's office was established in 1850 and maintains the complete records of the official acts of the legislature and executive branches of state government, as well as the Golden State history, in the form of tens of millions of documents, maps, photographs, film, and audio recordings, and more. And whereas as custodian of the State Archives, the California Secretary of State bears the responsibility and challenges of researchers working to identify, collect, preserve, and provide access to California history. And whereas without national, state, and local archives to preserve and maintain records and provide public access to the records, people would, for example, find it impossible to research the actions of the government, the evolution of a family's cultural heritage, or the changes in land borders and property rights over time. And whereas archivists are essential to ensuring that valuable records and other treasures are safely kept and made available for future generations. Now, therefore, be it resolved, the Society of American Archivists is welcome to California and wished every success for the organization's 76th annual meeting. Subscribed the 6th day of August, 2012, Deborah Bowen, Secretary of State. Thank you.
And now we are happy to introduce SAA President Gregor Trinkus Randall.
Good morning. It is my great pleasure to welcome you to Beyond Borders, SAA's 76th annual meeting. We have a very full agenda for this first session, so I'll just dive in. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the colleagues whom we've lost since the last meeting. Please join me in a moment of silence as we honor the 10 individuals whose names appear on the screen. Thank you. I know you'll find a wonderful array of opportunities for you to meet, learn, grow, and enjoy the company of your colleagues at this meeting. The educational program is at the heart of SAA's annual meeting, of course. And we were so lucky this past year to have the right people at the table to work on our outstanding educational program based on your outstanding session proposals. Will the 2012 program committee members please stand as their names are called and remain standing until we acknowledge you as a group? Co-chair Petrina Jackson, at the University of Virginia, co-chair Robert Spindler, Arizona State University, Sarah Buchanan, the Neon Museum, Ricardo Ferranti, the Smithsonian Institute Archives, Kathleen Hurdle Baker, Sisters of Charity of Nazareth, Kira Homo, University of Oregon, Nadia Nazir from Towson University, Tiffany Sherman from the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History, Mark Shelstad, University of Texas at San Antonio, Taylor, Louis de la Parte, Florida Mental Health Institute Research Library, and Brittany Turner of Brittany Turner Consulting. Please join me in thanking your very dynamic program committee. The host committee for a venue like San Diego has an incredibly easy job, right? Who wouldn't want to spend several days in the city with the best weather in the country? But this group did much, much more than rest on San Diego's laurels. They lined up open houses and tours with some of the most interesting repositories in the country. They created a blog and compiled for it a comprehensive dining guide, travel information, and tips for navigating the city's byways. They welcome you to their hometown at our advanced registration desk. Our 2012 host committee did this and more with great enthusiasm and perpetually sunny dispositions. Will the 2012 host committee members who aren't staffing the advanced registration desk at the moment stand as their names are called and remain standing until we can acknowledge them as a group? Chair Artis Kosbiel from the University of California in San Diego, Aubrey Carrier, Wells Fargo and Company Archives, Eric Chin, NBC Universal, Stephen Coy, UC San Diego, Cristela Garcia Spitz from UC San Diego, and the shining light behind the host committee's blog, Timothy Gladson, the Geothermal Resources Council, Helene Edels from Escondido Public Library, Amy Jankowski from the San Diego Zoo Global, Jane Keneally, San Diego History Center, Nancy Lanoil, California State Archives, Diane Maher, University of San Diego, Kelly McElhenney from UC San Diego, Stephanie Mirkin, San Diego History Center, Brandon Oswald, Island Culture Archival Support, Katrina Pescador, San Diego Air and Space Museum, Alan Renga, UC San Diego, Jeffrey Shermer, Quintales Incorporated, and he's also our photographer, Bradley Westbrook, UC San Diego, and Kim Schwenk from UC San Diego. Please join me in thanking our 2012 host committee. I'd also like to acknowledge SAA's past presidents in attendance. Please stand when I call your name and remain standing until all have been recognized. From 2009 to 2010, Peter Gottlieb, now retired from the Wisconsin State Archives. From 2008 to 2009, Frank Bowles, Central Michigan University. 2005-2006, Richard Pierce Moses, Clayton State University. 2004-2005, Rand Jimerson, Western Washington University. 1997-98, Bill Maher, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. 1994-95, Mae Jean Daniels, National Gallery of Art. And from 1989 to 1990, John Fleckner, now retired from the National Museum of American History. Not among our ranks this year, for the first time in a long time, is 2007-2008 President Mark Green. Some of you may know Mark experienced a spinal cord infarction in June. He is being released home from rehab this week, and our thoughts are with Mark and his wife, Kathy Marquis, as they face the challenges ahead. Among SAA's very challenging strategic priorities is that of enhancing public awareness of the many contributions of archives and archivists to our society. We have championed participation in American Archives Week month for the past 7 years, and for the past two have encouraged our members to participate in our I Found It in the Archives initiative during and after the American Archives Month. The premise of I Found It in the Archives is that archivists ask their users to share their stories of discovery. They hold local contests to select the best essay or video and engage in the use of social media to conduct both the promotion and voting. Local winners are then entered into the SAA's national contest. I'm happy to say that in year two of the national contest, more than 8,000 votes were cast. And the 2012 winner is Julie Dresser of Sycamore, Illinois, who found something very special in the archives of the State University of New York, Plattsburgh, with the assistant of archivist Deborah Kimmick. Would Julie and Deborah please rise so we can congratulate them? Julie's prize was a trip to this meeting, and I hope that she's enjoying this beautiful city. She and Deborah will be available at the I Found It table in the registration area to meet you and answer any questions you might have about their experience in this initiative. We are trying something a little different this year with our very robust recognition program. We're splitting up the awards, scholarships, and fellows recognition among several of our public events. This year, we will acknowledge our incoming class of distinguished fellows during this plenary session. Three members of our committee to select fellows will introduce the five newly elected fellows. Chris?
Good morning. I'm Chris Prom from the University of Illinois Archives, a fellow of the Society and a member of the Fellows Selection Committee. I'm delighted to make our first introduction this morning. In his writings, our first inductee encourages us to pursue archival work as a covenant of faith, and his own life epitomizes the power of that ideal. He has dedicated his career to forming partnerships as true collaborations rooted in individual and collective responsibility. As a result, his work points all of us toward ways in which archivists contribute toward societal good and human welfare. He fosters genuine encounters between people, making him one of our profession's best ambassadors. His work to engage people from all walks of life was instrumental in making the Seattle Municipal Archives a nationwide model for effective archival programs, and, as a matter of fact, led the city to name a day in his honor, something few of us will ever be able to experience. Certainly, I will never be able to experience. As a teacher at the University of Washington and as a mentor in many locations, he has exposed countless students and colleagues to a philosophy that, above all, helps people to see archival work as a matter of historical contemplation and self-understanding instead of a mere set of theories and practical skills. In his service to the profession and society, our inductee has shown what he calls sacred obligation in a forthcoming article, which you will all be reading. While serving as a charter member of the Academy of Certified Archivists, a leader in SAA Council or in NAGARA, or in many other roles, he has emerged as a genuine leader, someone trusted, someone impartial, who brings out the best in others and who helps them feel valued for their contributions. Finally, he illustrates what he calls piety of service. Our inductee strives to perform his archival duty in a way that fosters equity, justice, and transparency. Perhaps there's no greater testimony to this than what you will read in his most recent writings, "To the Limit of Our Integrity, Reflections on Archival Being." And this is interesting, "Dust clouds of camels shall cover you, covenant and the archival endeavor." In my case, reading both of these pieces has made me a better archivist, and it will make you a better archivist as well. They richly deserve a favored place in our archival canon, not only in this generation, but in generations to come. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in saluting someone whose recognition as a distinguished fellow of the Society brings as much honor to the Society as to himself, Scott Klein.
Good morning. My name is Frank Bowles, and I am honored to introduce as a new fellow of the Society, Dr. Peter Gottlieb, the only one of us so confident in his professional skills, he does not need a tie. In more than 30 years of service to the profession, Peter Gottlieb has distinguished himself as an archivist, an author, and a leader within our organizations. Peter's professional career began in West Virginia and included time in Pennsylvania, but he is best known as the State Archivist of Wisconsin, a position he held from 1991 until his retirement in 2010. As State Archivist, he served with distinction and vision, an early and informed advocate urging his staff and his profession to deal with the daunting challenge of a world migrating from paper to electronic records, and serving as a strong advocate and a strong proponent for advocacy, recognizing and calling on us to recognize that good things do not necessarily come to those who stand in wait. Peter's publications, both within the realm of historical scholarship and within the arena of the archival profession, have been both useful and influential. Among his many positions of leadership within our profession, he has served as chair of the Council of State Archivists, and played a vital role in that organization's emergence as a separate 501c3 organization, served on the Council of the Midwest Archives Conference, and as president of the Society of American Archivists. The vita, however, is not the person. It is an individual's personal qualities that, in the end, make them a fellow. Nominators praise Peter's, and I quote, "calm, strategic, and often innovative approaches to the challenges we face in the profession," end quote. Nominees described him as, quote, "responsible for getting diverse groups of people to work together toward a common goal in many different contexts," end quote. For example, under Peter's guidance, genealogists and lawyers, not normal allies, found a common bond in supporting the archives. Nominees described his as, quote, "a voice of quiet authority, and one that considers not only the immediate issue, but the long-term implications," end quote. Nominators praise Peter's leadership of the Wisconsin State Historical Records Advisory Board, making it, in the words of another nominator, quote, "a great role model for all the SHRAVs in the United States," end quote. Importantly, nominators praise his ability to, and again I quote, "to convey the value of archives and the archival profession at the national level." Most importantly, nominators wrote, and I quote here, "for Peter, it's never been about the power or the glory. It's about his responsibility to a profession for which he cares so deeply. For carrying out that responsibility in so many distinguished and exemplary ways, I am pleased to welcome Peter among the fellows of the Society."
Good morning. My name is Peter Walsh, and I am very pleased to introduce Lancy Lanoyle as a newly elected SAA Fellow. Nancy has distinguished herself as an expert in the field of archival continuing education, as the State Archivist of California, and as a contributor to the leadership of the Society of American Archivists. One of her nominators tells a story about meeting Nancy at a Society of California Archivists conference in 1987. After this first SCA meeting, Nancy decided that she wanted to move to California and build her archives career there. The nominator was impressed that Nancy accomplished her move to this land of fruit and nuts within a few months. In his words, she had a goal, made a plan, prepared herself, kept herself open for opportunities, and was ready when Lady Luck knocked on her door in 1987. And this approach has characterized Nancy's role in the profession. Notably, Nancy has served as administrator of the highly regarded Western Archives Institute for 15 years, relinquishing this position only when she became State Archivist of California, but maintaining the State Archives commitment and administrative support as co-sponsor of the program. She continues her association with the Western Archives Institute as a faculty member. With this long experience in continuing education, Nancy was asked to write an assessment of the A-Census Project survey data on archivists' post-appointment training. Her masterful essay on this topic in The American Archivist has won wide recognition and praise. Another nominator cited the mastery of archival processes, administration, and leadership that sets Nancy apart. Her administration of the Robert F. Kennedy assassination investigation files at the State Archives perhaps best exemplified her superb skills. Colleagues well beyond California also recognized her ability when they elected her to SAA's nominating committee and later to the SAA Council. In these professional leadership positions, and she has held many others, Nancy has contributed, in another nominator's words, through her willingness to share her experience, insights, and passion for archives with everyone that she encounters. Her accomplishments, her professional dedication, and her leadership all make Lancy Lanoyle an exemplary archivist and an embodiment of the ideal sought in a nominee for fellow. So Nancy, congratulations, and welcome to the ranks of SAA Fellow. Well, good morning again. My name is still Peter Walsh, I think. And I'm actually equally delighted to introduce Ben Primmer as a newly elected fellow. And I have to say I'm up here actually pinch-hitting for Mark Green, who, as was mentioned earlier, is ill and regretfully could not attend this year's meeting. But I'm happy to say that Mark did prepare the following remarks concerning Ben Primmer, and I will read them as he wrote them. So just in the sake... It is a little, actually, it's scarier than you think, Ben. So anyway, for the sake of archival authenticity and accuracy, these are Mark's words, not mine. As is usually the case, the nomination letters for our next fellow provide some quotable characterizations, and his resume supplies the rest of the picture. That resume, by the way, submitted with his nomination, was at least 3 years old, but was still more than 7 pages long, single-spaced. That resume follows him from project administrator, not mere archivist, in Baltimore in 1980 to associate university librarian at Princeton since 1999. It lists 15 grants secured, although it doesn't mention his private fundraising success, 11 publications, and 17 presentations, and this is only through 2009. It also lists his extensive service on behalf of the Mid-Atlantic Regional Archives Conference, the New Jersey State Historical Records Advisory Board, and, of course, SAA. For SAA, he currently serves on its foundation board, has served on council, has co-chaired a program committee, and served on two others. His admirers state that he takes on professional responsibilities that need doing, even if they are not flashy or likely to result in personal attention. He does that which needs to be done for the betterment of his institution and staff. His regional colleagues and organizations, and our profession at the national level. They say that his professional talents, generosity, and humility are remarkable. They say his intelligence, wisdom, hard work, cheerfulness, and collegiality have made it possible for him to accomplish important and often groundbreaking achievements that have helped our organizations and our profession to move forward. And they say, quote, "I think his greatest contribution to the profession is his indefatigable optimism for accomplishing what needs to be done. His bedrock belief in archives makes him that irresistible force that has not yet encountered an immovable object." Having known Ben Primmer for most of my archival career, having the great good fortune to count him as a mentor and friend, and this is Mark Green's words, having had him as a member of the 2000 SAA program committee that I co-chaired, and then serving with him again during his last year on SAA Council while I was vice president, I will only add that Ben is at once level-headed and energetic, principled and humble, cheerful in a curmudgeonly kind of way, and uncompromising in his dedication to providing access to archives for researchers. He's an outstanding archivist, a widely admired mentor, and well-deserving of the honor of Distinguished Fellow of the Society of American Archivists. So congratulations, Ben.
Yes, I'm back. Living proof that good help is still hard to find in some places in the society. Unfortunately, Helen Thibault, who was to introduce our next fellow, could not be with us today. So I'm going to read her remarks. And when I begin by saying, "I'm Helen Thibault," you'll see where we're going. "I'm Helen Thibault, professor of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and immediate past president of SAA. And it is my great pleasure to present Timothy Pyatt as an SAA fellow. I have known Tim since he first arrived at the University of North Carolina in 1995, and I have long admired his professionalism and ethics, teaching ability, and inquisitive and highly organized mind. Tim has led a distinguished career as an archival practitioner, administrator, teacher, and scholar, and a leader, and he has amassed major contributions to the profession in several areas. Timothy Pyatt is currently the Huck Chair and Head of Special Collections of Penn State's University Libraries. Prior to moving to Pennsylvania, Tim spent several years in North Carolina at those two schools that sport various shades of blue, one involving devil worship." Remember, I'm only reading it. "From 1999 to 2002, Tim was the director of the Southern Historical Collection at UNC Chapel Hill. You might well imagine the shock when he traded jerseys to work for his alma mater as Duke's university archivist until this past winter. For some of us, this was the same thing as if Dean Smith had become a Duke basketball coach." "Tim proved that he could excel in both institutions and bridge the Tobacco Road gap and continued as professor of practice with the UNC School of Information and Library Science. Tim is undoubtedly best known in SAA and in the broader archival community for his work with ethics. He has spent over a decade as steering committee member, vice chair, and chair of the Privacy and Confidentiality Roundtable. He is currently chair of the Committee on Ethics and Professional Conduct and created a revised code of SAA ethics, a potentially perilous task indeed. One of the CEPC committee members described the leadership role of Tim Pyatt and that he assumed for CEPC. This is a lengthy quote, but I can see why Helen picked it. "Tim Pyatt has done a superb job of steering the committee through these sometimes treacherous waters. He worked successfully to involve all committee members in the code revision process. He was a skillful communicator throughout, providing deft summaries of the progress that had been made and the developing reasonable work plans committee members to follow to ensure that drafts were submitted to council in a timely fashion. Tim took the lead in soliciting feedback from SAA members and in distilling the essence of this feedback so that the committee could make the most effective use of it." End quote. The result was a successful approval of a newly revised code, a major accomplishment. It is once again my great pleasure to present SAA's newest fellow, Timothy Pyatt. Oh, one last thing to savor, Tim. The announcement of becoming an SAA fellow should not get top billing over those pesky lemurs in the Duke magazine. Congratulations.
Thank you all, and congratulations to the new fellows. A major theme throughout my presidency has been the importance of cooperation and collaboration, both within our profession and with allied professions and organizations. We simply must challenge our traditional borders and get beyond them. On April 9th, I attended a session at Harvard University entitled Libraries, Archives, and Museums, A Strategic Conversation, in which three individuals spoke compellingly about the critical need for archives, libraries, and museums to converge, to collaborate in education and advocacy, and to work together to provide greater access to collections that complement each other. One participant in that session was David Ferriero. Although David and I have been in touch throughout the year on various matters, including the funding situation that NHPRC faces perpetually, this session helped me crystallize my conviction that the information professions must work together to move forward in a variety of ways and fronts at this time of increasing challenges to our professions. David merged, some would say evolved, from his work in libraries to an especially challenging job in November 2009 when he was confirmed as the 10th Archivist of the United States. Please join me in welcoming Collector-in-Chief and Archivist of the United States, David Ferriero.
Good morning. So I'm delighted to be back in San Diego, one of my favorite cities in the world. And in the fall of 1991, when I was here, I broke away from the conference I was supposed to be attending to take a harbor tour. And the tour guide stopped his spiel and walked over to me and said, "Excuse me, but are you Oliver North?" A true story. And I can pinpoint roughly the time it happened because Oliver North appeared on the cover of Time magazine a week of October 28, 1991. So it was sometime right after that. I wasn't quick enough on my feet to play with the, because I was just so shocked. So it's really nice to be back. I'm joined here this morning by a lot of my staff. So would all of the NARA staff please stand up? So when I became archivist, I made a commitment to Peter and Nancy to get as many NARA staff involved as I could. So I continue to do that. And I'm very proud to be in the same room with you this morning. So are there other federal employees in the room? If you are, please stand along with NARA staff. Get back up. Very good. So in April, when you're paying your taxes, I want you to remember these wonderful colleagues and reward them by paying your taxes on time. So Gregor asked me to talk about just to highlight my remarks from that Harvard meeting. But I'm as the archivist, I'm using my prerogative to talk about three things this morning. Okay. Three things that are important, including that one. But let me start with the thing that's most on my mind today, and that is managing government records and the directive that's about to come out of the White House, perhaps today, perhaps tomorrow, but surely within the next couple of days, triggered by a memorandum from the President that was issued at the end of November 2011 that went to every agency, a memorandum on managing government records, marking the beginning of the executive branch-wide effort to reform records management policies and practices and to develop a 21st century framework for the management of government records. The memorandum is historic, and it's the first in that it is the first time since the Truman administration that the White House has paid this much attention to the records of our country. My favorite two sentences in the memorandum: when records are well managed, agencies can use them to assess the impacts of programs, to reduce redundant efforts, to save money, and to share knowledge within and across their organizations. In these ways, proper records management is the backbone of open government. The memorandum called upon each agency to name a senior agency official responsible for records management, for each agency to identify the obstacles they are experiencing in their management of records, especially electronic records, and for the issuance by me and the acting director of the Office of Management and Budget of a directive on managing government records. That directive has been drafted, reviewed, and about to be issued, as I said. The directive is organized around two central goals, one requiring electronic record keeping and the other demonstrating compliance with federal records management statutes and regulations. By the end of 2013, each agency must have developed and must have begun implementation of plans to transition from paper to electronic for permanent records. And by the end of 2016, all federal agencies must manage all email records in electronic format. That may sound simple, and it may sound like a no-brainer, but the guidance today is print and save. Federal Records Act has not been changed. The directive also requires that all agencies must establish records management training and that records are scheduled regardless of format. The directive also articulates actions that NARA, the Office of Management and Budget, and the Office of Personnel Management will take to support the agencies in meeting these two central goals. NARA will be revising our transfer guidance for permanent electronic records and creating new email guidance. NARA, working with the Federal Chief Information Officers Council and the Federal Records Council, will be working with private industry and other stakeholders to produce viable automated records management solutions, including open source solutions. And NARA will work with OPM to establish, this is my favorite, NARA will be working with OPM to establish a formal records management occupation series to elevate management roles, responsibilities, and skill sets for agency records officers and other records professionals. NARA will overhaul the general record schedule, reducing the need for unique record schedules and therefore reducing the scheduling and appraisal burden on agencies. Kudos to our Chief Records Officer, Paul Wester. Paul, would you please stand up? Paul has led the effort of working with the stakeholders, with the agencies, to process all of the input that has been received and to craft, working with our friends in the White House, a directive that will work for us. I should also mention, on the White House side, without the help of Cass Sunstein, the Administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs within the Office of Management and Budget, this would not have happened. Cass announced his retirement on last Friday. He's going back to teaching at Harvard. We're certainly going to miss him, but we really appreciate the seriousness with which he took this assignment. So, records management. Second has to do with some thinking that I have been doing about the future. And in December, I will be convening a meeting of archives, libraries, and museum folks to talk about the convergence of our missions and the skill set necessary to accomplish that work and how we can work together to create the next generation of professionals in our institutions. This will be a mix of educators, practitioners, prospective employees to focus on our similarities rather than our differences and what we can learn from each other. After many, many, many years in the information profession, with responsibilities in each one of these lives that spanned these three disciplines, I'm convinced that we have more in common than we have acknowledged to date. And most recently, thanks to the entree provided my own Wikipedian in residence, I've had an opportunity to get to know and spend time with the GLAM community. And I've waited a long time to be able to say that I'm a member of the GLAM community, where the commonalities among the communities drive their work. And I understand that the leaders of ALA, SLA, and the American Association of Museums are also convening a leadership meeting on this topic. So there will be interesting opportunities for engagement in the days ahead. As for the December meeting in Washington, more information to come. In the meantime, I'm happy to hear your thoughts on the topic, participants, and your level of interest in engaging this conversation. And I'll be doing a blog on this soon. Third, I want to bring you up to date on the Digital Public Library of America. I hope there isn't anyone in this room who has not heard of the Digital Public Library of America. In October 2010, at a meeting at the Radcliffe Institute convened by Robert Darnton of Harvard, a group of about 40 people got together to discuss the idea of an initiative to both provide access to the digital content already in existence across the country and to stimulate the creation of new content, to provide a portal to all the cultural heritage resources of this country. This was a concept that Bob Darnton had been talking to me about for several years in my former life at the New York Public Library. Bob was a trustee there and concerned about Google's corner on the market of American digital content. So about 40 individuals, as I said, representing academic and public libraries, museum, government agencies, including the National Archives, private foundations, technologists, and lawyers convened in Cambridge for a day to dream what could be, and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation put $5 million on the table to get serious. With administrative support from the Berkman Center at Harvard, work began. A steering committee appointed, 8 work streams created and populated, dealing with governance, content and scope, audience and participation, financial and business models, legal issues, and technical aspects. In October of 2011, several hundred folks gathered at the National Archives to provide input and support for the project, and another meeting in San Francisco this past April provided another opportunity for public input. Both public and private financial support has been rewarding to see, literally. The Acadia Foundation has provided another $5 million, and most recently, the National Endowment for the Humanities has provided $1 million to help us create the technical platform for the sharing of digital content, all of which leading to a prototype launch in April of 2013. I urge you to get involved, to check out the DPLA site, www.dp.la, and follow the progress and contribute your ideas, and most importantly, be thinking of your own content contributions to this effort. I remain at the table because of my belief that the archives of this country have the best stuff and have been largely overlooked in the major digitization projects so far. So DPLA will change that. Thanks.
Thank you, David. We are delighted this morning to be joined by John Voss, History Pin Strategic Partnerships Director for London-based nonprofit We Are What We Do. In that capacity, John is helping to build an open ecosystem of historical data across libraries, archives, and museums worldwide. In his work at the intersection of history and technology, he's jump-starting important projects ranging from the development of institutional infrastructure, like linked open data, and game-changing conferences and working groups, to consumer-facing web and mobile products. He organized the first international linked open data in libraries, archives, and museums summit in 2011, as well as the Humanities and Technology Unconference, that camp, Bay Area. He is the founder of Look Back Maps and project manager of Civil War Data 150, a collaborative project to share and connect Civil War-related data across local, state, and federal institutions during the four-year sesquicentennial of the American Civil War. Please join me in welcoming John Voss.
Good morning. It's an honor to be here with you. I am a huge fan of Archivist, and it's great to be on the inside and see the initiation ritual that happens at the beginning, which is pretty fascinating. In fact, I'm the president of the California Archivist Fanboy Collective, and we decided this year to use Green Bay Packer memorabilia to gather autographs and things like that. So you might see some of my fellows around the lobby looking for you when you come out. Just, you know, be gracious with them. They can get a little bit excited. But I wasn't always a groupie, I have to say, and a fanboy. I was skeptical at first. In 2008, when I first started working with archival photos, trying to do something which to me seemed pretty simple, putting historical photos on a map so that I could see the history of my neighborhood across archival collections. And when I first started talking to archivists, I was really amazed to find, you know, I said, you know, if I can do it, why aren't you doing it? You know, why isn't this happening already? So I was a little bit, you know, nervous about that and approaching them. And one of my first meetings was with Lori Lindbergh. And she kind of talked me off the cliff there a little bit and said, John, calm down. We archive things so that people can find them. I mean, that's the whole point. And that was a really exciting turning moment for me, working with people like Mark Harvey, the archivist of the state of Michigan, and others now around the world, to find that there is this real interest of sharing and having a collective experience across the libraries, archives, museums, the DPLA, as you mentioned. Just incredible developments. So Lori and I and a bunch of others back in 2009 started looking, talking with technologists, talking with others, developers, how can we start to find solutions that will get us to the next step? And we started talking about this idea of linked data.
Remember when libraries, archives, and museums captured imaginations that connected information and led the internet revolution?
Aside from really cool hairdos back then, this was the library experience to me as I entered college, 1991. And it was this radical idea of coming out of the card catalogs and interfacing with technology in a way that would help us find information. This is where the internet revolution began. It was in the libraries and in the archives. And the really important point for us, you know, and for me, as a college student, was that not only could I find information, but very soon after, I could start to find people and make connections. So we started by finding the books. We ended by finding the people. And if we think back a little bit to the evolution of the web, this is a great site called evolutionoftheweb.com. And you can see here in 1991, it's hard to see on this map, but that blue arrow, that very first blue arrow, is the HTTP protocol, right? This hypertext protocol. That you could start to do this crazy thing of linking one document to another. That was all it was. That's how the World Wide Web began. And you were thinking about this Beyond Borders idea and this theme, I started to think about what else was going on in the world then. And you might look in 1989, 1990, You had Nelson Mandela being freed, the fall of apartheid. You had the fall of the Berlin Wall. You had perestroika happening. I mean, so much exciting things in the world. This, and it's not a coincidence, I don't think, that out of that context, that global context, came this desire to connect with one another in new ways. That was how the World Wide Web started. That's what it was about. And then as time went on, you could see all the different technologies that would flow into this, and it doesn't all fit on the screen, but it brings us up to the current day, where we have so many things. You use the web, we take it for granted. But it began with that very first notion of connecting one another with documents, and then connecting to the people behind those documents. So today I want to talk about linked open data in libraries, archives, and museums, and talk to you a little bit about what it is. Not too much. We'll dig into the law, the technology, and the culture that makes this possible. And it's this culture that's very much a part of what we're talking about when we bridge libraries, archives, and museums. It's radically open cultural heritage data on the web. So this is a visualization of a track, and it's really, to me, embodies the idea of mashup culture, right? To wake you up. What happens when we take music, movies, everything from across generations, and we mix it together? So here you have Belinda Carlisle from the 80s. You've got Afro-Rican providing the beat. If anyone recognizes that, a little Layla to get it going. You put it together to create one experience. And it's a really exciting environment to be within. I mean, this is mashup culture. That's how I live as somebody who grew up on the web. That's what I expect of my information these days. These kind of images, you know, are either your worst nightmare or a dream come true. I'm talking to the dreamers, I think, because this is a dream to me. The DJ in the archives, and you know what we can start to do with that. But we're not that far from this, I think. I mean, if you look, this is a great example here of 2010. The National Archives did a postcard contest, photo contest. And they asked people, they said, look, our content is open. It's free for you to use. And we want you to take it and put it in place and see what you can do with it. And I submitted, using some technology which would then become part of HistoryPin, an app that would take you to a place and overlay a photo. So here's a gate in San Francisco, Japantown. And when you overlay a Dorothy Lange photo, all of a sudden you see the import of that location and what lies behind those places. And here this photo is heads of households after Pearl Harbor, having to check in what would become the beginning of their 4 years or so in concentration camps around the United States. But I'm not alone in doing that, so that was a great project, but we're seeing other people start to take content and do other things with them, mash them up. Take Swedish artist Sanna Dolaway and taking old photos and colorizing them. It's a very simple thing, it's a mashup, but it changes your experience of it. Or this photo here, which the Bikini Atoll. But when you colorize that, all of a sudden, that horrible moment seems so much more real. Well, it's not all so heavy. There's also enthusiasts who are doing things like Burrito Justice in San Francisco, who wanted to take this old ballpark, which is no longer there, in the Mission, and put it back on the map. So they used old photos, Sanborn maps, and went into Safeway and Office Depot, where that stadium is now, and put the bases on the floor, actually. Or you take oldsf.org, another great place. We have so many technologists and enthusiasts there and history buffs as well, right? So oldsf.org is a project by a developer who was living in the Mission in San Francisco and found a photo of his house on San Francisco Public Library. Really wanted to see it on a map. He couldn't do it that way, so he screen scraped the entire site and took 10,000 of the 40,000 photos and was able to make pins of them on the map, create this experience. And he came to me after we launched HistoryPin. He said, hey, I made this thing. I want to launch. I'm like, wait a minute. We should probably talk to the library first. Just see what they say. I think they'll be into it. And they were, actually, you know. So they were really excited about this project. But that's the point here is that people want access to this content and they can do things with it. Here's another one that just came out, PassMapper, and we could go on and on. You know, this is a guy who took all the data from 1960s lounges around San Francisco and built an app that you can now check into those lounges. You know, so you're going in. This is the Golden Pheasant, as seen in Bullet, right? So let's spend a minute talking about the technology behind this idea of linked open data. So there's linked data and there's open data. They're capitalized because there are specific protocols behind them. And so linked data gives us the ability to start to move beyond tables. This is how we're dealing with information now. And the computing power, the experience of the World Wide Web has taken us to a point where this can really not scale anymore, where tables cannot scale anymore. So we're moving to a graph. We're going from tables to graphs. This is an example of a Twitter network, for instance, at an on-conference, how people were connected. And you start to see the importance of nodes and links. It's a really simple idea, and that's what it revolves around, that every piece of information is a node, and the way it relates to another piece of information is the link. And as that computing power increases, we're able to visualize things in new ways. So while we might see a graph with this indication of a small Twitter network, the machine will see it represented on the right in a table, you know, and see it interpreted that way. So the key to linked data is triples. That's the concept. And it's subject, predicate, object. Nodes and links. So we're going to keep with this Twitter example just to make it simple. So, for instance, I follow Archives Next. I mean, who doesn't? You know, subject, predicate, object. Me follows Archives Next, right? Now, this gives us the ability to take any piece of information and make it available on the web in a way that machines can read it. So we take it a little bit further. Look at Ed Summers, the Library of Congress. He's always a willful guinea pig. What do we know about Ed? You know, we know that he knows Dan up on the right. So Ed knows Dan. Ed knows Jody on the bottom right. We know that we have photos of him on the web as well. And we know his bio, right? So these are the triples. His bio is hacker for libraries, digital archaeologist, pragmatist. We serialize that information in a number of ways. RDF is one of the main acronyms you want to know, Resource Description Framework. But basically, that means how we break down those triples into statements that machines can read, all right? The subject, predicate, object. And you can have a lot of variations of that. The technology is still evolving. We're very early in this world of linked data, in this new web, right? But when we break it down this way, we create simple rules and protocols. We can start to dig into it. So we've almost translated our information to a way that the machines can talk to us and we can talk to them. Now, it's a little early in the morning, but I'm going to show you some code. It's not that threatening, actually. You understand the idea of triples now, right? The subject, predicate, object. And behind the web, when you look behind how things work, when we see how, you know, these great visualizations that we see on the web, behind it is the information and how that's laid out. And if you're familiar with XML, this is an RDF XML sheet. And basically the top line, I'm sure you can't read this, but the top line tells us that this is an RDF sheet. Everything after that is going to be a representation of those triples, right? So in this case, everything here is about Ed Summers. And as you go down that list, you'll see that we've got his first name, his last name, his surname, a bunch of information. We've got his email here. Now, this is an RDF page that Ed Summers made. This is all the kind of information that he gives us about the web, his Twitter account, his Flickr account, his email address. You know, it's kind of scary how much information he's giving us of the web. But it's out there, and he's put it out there in a way that machines can find it and build this graph of knowledge. So if we know that his Twitter account is this, now we can go out and find his friends. We can use the grow that web, go a little bit further and get more information, all right? That's all it is. It becomes a little bit more complicated as we implement it, but those are the basic ideas of linked data, all right? What happens if we apply this to the humanities? And that's really what the Civil War Data 150 project has been about, a very early prototype of considering a graph of information. When you take it beyond just people or places. But what if we started to map the Civil War? And so in this graph at the top, you can sort of see the example of the 1st Michigan Colored Regiment. You know, this is a state historical marker. So we have all the information about where the historical markers are. We also have the regimental flags around the world and different around the country in different ways. We have maps of the battles that they participated to the right. We know the generals who commanded that. And you can start to pull together the photos of those people, the information about those people, the monuments. You know, you can go back the other way, to the left, and see, you know, one of the particular soldiers who served, and then find his pension records, his death records. Those all exist, the maps of the state that he lived in, etc. And it builds a very compelling view of the war and of the information related to it. So here it all revolves around the simple connections of regiments, battles, and places. If we can link things to those three concepts, we can really build interesting visualizations. Here's an example, conflict history. This is not just related to the Civil War. It actually shows all of the conflicts of humankind that have been recorded in Wikipedia. And it turns out that there have been a lot of conflicts in humankind. And this is just the ones that exist in the United States between 1861 and 1865. Here, this map, because we have that information in Wikipedia, it's structured data, we can make it available. You can also look on the map and find the battles, zoom in on them, right? See a little bit more information. And here, this is feeding on Wikipedia, it's feeding on Freebase. You can go down into the battle level, the Battle of Iuka, and you'll notice that it's automatically pulling a map of that battle, right? Because we know that they're related across those different triples or pieces of information. Then you can relate this to the books as well. So this is an example on the Open Library Project at Internet Archive. And here's one of probably 600 or so regimental histories that they have. And the Open Library already has, you know, they're creating a page for every book. Behind that code, as we showed you, is an RDF page as well. And this is early RDF, but this tells us that everything about that book can be related to the Library of Congress subject headings, for instance. We can look and see what, you know, follow those links along. Now, in this instance of it, they haven't all been linked together yet, so we're still getting there. I want to make clear that this is a work in progress. We're building this together right now. Right? And then start to feed in other layers of that. Here's the Visualizing Emancipation Project out of University of Richmond. And they take that, the regimental histories, the regimental kind of positions, and start to add other information to that, connect to that the story of emancipation and how that evolved and was it connected, asking humanities research questions of how that might be connected, right? So we continue. I mean, this is the answer to the so what of linked open data. You know, what's it good for? And I think for us, we're starting to explore at HistoryPen, which is my day job, you know, which was all really about building a better time machine and building community around history, where we've got, you know, we just surpassed 400 institutions that are contributing data. HistoryPen, you know, people have their own channels, the National Archives, University of Louisville, et cetera. You know, people are embedding these tools and creating things. It's not driven by linked data, but we're getting to the point of saying, what can we do if it is? How can that information be linked? You know, and here's a visualization. By the way, I brought some stickers with me, so if you're one of the 400 on this list, and I know many of you are, you know, come and see me. We'll do some stickers. What happens when you start to visualize this information in a compelling interface? You know, here we are at the Coronado in San Diego, bringing this back to life, making that part of the mobile experience. So we're just starting to scratch the surface of how we can apply this linked data. Here's another example of a project we're working on with King's College in London with a JISC grant, where because we have the date and the place, we can dig a little bit deeper. And here we're experimenting using linked data to find out what other collections might be relevant to this date and place that you've just dropped into. You know, so you can go deeper and see, well, we've got a collection here at this university that may be relevant to what you're looking at, and start to build better implementations. This is another great example of a PhD candidate in Australia. He's studying museum studies and computer science, which is an amazing combination. And what he's done here is he's used a couple different algorithms and engines to visualize the Brooklyn Museum collections through their API. And he's also demonstrated that you can start to take multiple collections and bring them together. And here he wants to show you the experience of walking down a hallway and randomly finding information. Well, the metadata actually tends to be linked together through common threads, right? So these are the kinds of things that we're starting to do because the technology is there and because the will is there to do it. So we can have linked data and we can have open data. You can have linked data without having open data, and you have open data without linked data. The great thing is when you combine them. But as much as having the technology tools, we also have the legal tools that exist now that did not exist years ago. And I think within this community, as everything changes around us, as industries change, the music industry, the movies industry, the same with the libraries and archives industry, but this community is a community of innovators, not litigators. And we're really looking at how to empower and support this kind of behavior. All right? How do we bring these makers into it? So one of the things that we've looked at that's really important, it's kind of technical, but separating the metadata versus the data and the assets themselves. You know, so you've got a license on this, how you can use this. This is Library of Congress, so we know it's public domain. But you may have another collection that has restrictions. But the metadata is something else. You know, you can give that another license. And as developers, technologists, can actually do quite a bit with that metadata if it's put out there in an open way. So here are some legal tools that we're looking at. The Creative Commons, right? So you've seen these, probably everyone's familiar with Creative Commons, I hope, but putting licenses on images or on metadata that we can easily understand and say, this is what you've got, this is how we can use it. So CC BY, CC 0, the public domain mark, these are all open licenses. And I always say open-ish is CC BY SA, right, to put a share alike. But each of these licenses give us a clear indication of how we can use it. Do we need to give attribution? How do we give that attribution? And feed this into the web of data, all right? Now, you can also use Creative Commons licenses to publish data that aren't open, and there's a whole series of them. You know, these acronyms are, you know, NC is non-commercial, ND is no derivatives, and you can stack those up and interchange them. But it gives us the ability to access things in new ways. So culture, technology, law, these are the environments in which this is starting to evolve. And it sounds a lot like a dream. Sounds crazy, I know. But it's not. If you look at a web search on Google today, type in U2, for instance, you'll notice, and we've started to see this over the last few months, few weeks, with the knowledge graph, that they're pulling data about U2, the band U2, from Wikipedia, from music databases, and starting to display that into your search. That's linked data. It's happening behind the scenes. And the question is whether or not we're going to play a part of that community. We need your expertise to add to this. You've been dealing with structured data for hundreds of years. Developers are going to make it accessible. We're going to build the technology for this. But it's really about sharing the stories and sharing the data. It's not about Google. The World Wide Web is so much bigger than Google. And we have to remember that and how we share those stories. If it's appealing to you, you're not alone. There's an entire community around the world that's getting involved in this. In 2010, for instance, at that time, the British Library, Stanford University, University of Michigan, several others were already involved in this. We had some of the building blocks of those links, the vocabulary, the VF files, the id.loc.gov. These are the subject headings of the Library of Congress that we can start to build the connections. Those were in place in 2010. And I don't know if you remember when we could map the internet. You could look at the World Wide Web on a map, right? This is the linked open data graph, or the linked data graph. And in 2010, this is what it looked like. In that year alone, that linked data cloud grew by 300%, all right? Like the web, it's growing exponentially. But the information specific to libraries grew by 1,000%, all right? So there's so much for this community to give to this. Just as David said, I mean, the importance of the underrepresented collections that exist. So in last summer, we created the Linked Open Data Libraries, Archives, and Museums Summit. It was a really exciting get-together. We wanted to attract maybe 50 people, if we could, from around the world. We ended up with 100 that made it, and we had to put in extra tables. You know, we didn't have enough fried chicken and waffles, so we had to move to another restaurant as well. I mean, there just wasn't enough space. And loadlam.net is where you can find out more about this community and be a part of this community. It's growing around the world. You can see these meetups starting to happen in different places and see the connections that are starting to be made. You can follow Loadlam on Twitter. If you're a Twitter user, you'll see a lot of information that's coming out there as well. Things like Stanford's workshop, which resulted in a technology plan that was published. Well, since then, 2011, you know, I mentioned those British Library, the Open Library, others that existed. That ecosystem is growing ever quicker. You see the Smithsonian putting things up on GitHub, for instance. Some of them are using open. You know, these are all public domain collections, metadata collections are going up. Some of them are linked data, and some of them are just open, right? But they're enabling us to work with it. Scientific data, the Harvard Libraries, University of Florida, the Nature Publishing Group, journals that are coming out that we can start to work with, and they use linked data. The Spanish and German national libraries, all putting their information out there in open ways that we can start to build from and use. And finally, Europeana, which has 15 million records that are now available as open and linked data for us to utilize. And my question to you is simply, you know, who's got next? Start to add your collections to these, and there's ways to do it. You know, as Harvey Milk was fond of saying, I'm here to recruit you. You know, this is, I want your data. I want to be able to use it, you know? And there are a lot of ways to get involved. It's not like this crazy technical thing. It's a community of users, right? So check out loadlam.net for one. Follow that Twitter handle, as I've shown you, loadlam. And then even here, right? Session 401 tomorrow. You've got a great group of thinkers in this space who are going to present. So check your schedule on where that is, session 401 tomorrow. But most of all, contribute. You know, think of how you can start to take your information and put it out there in ways that we can use it. Start small, but start. Start with maybe a Civil War collection or some one collection. Put it out there as a CSV file, you know, in a way that people can use. And you'll see a lot of information on how to do this. You know, these friendly Belgians are here to help you too. Using tools like Google Refine, which gives us the ability to actually work with metadata in ways that we've never had the opportunity to do before. You know, dig in. There's ways to get into this, right? I want to end with one more mashup. And this is a video that was put together from NASA archive images. You know, they take tens of thousands, millions of photos from the International Space Station. And enthusiasts have put them together into videos. Like, these are just everyday people making something, all right? We don't know what people will do with our data, and we need to embrace that uncertainty. That is the culture and the community of the World Wide Web. It's not just something you go to view. It's something that we make together. And it sounds difficult. It sounds like a dream. But there are people living in space right now. 3,500 people worked hard for 7 years to put a rover on Mars last week. It's hard, but we can do it if we have one goal that is moving us beyond borders, as you say here. When you look from this view, the borders don't make a whole lot of sense. Not from our institutions, not from our countries, not from Berlin, from Mexico. And the web has made this a reality. Now more than ever. It was started as a way to connect to people. We need to fight to keep those connections free and open. It's not something that we could sit and let companies, corporations, countries lock up. So we've started with a web of documents. That's how the web started. We're moving to a web of data. This community, the library, the archive, the museum communities are going to play a key part of that. All right, we're on this tiny little globe for just an instance. Just an instant. And we all know that better than anyone. You're preserving for future generations. And I think that we could do something great together. Thank you.
Thank you, John. I think you've opened up a lot of eyes, and I hope we're, as you said, we need to join in. As archivists, we are gathered here to learn, to network, meet new colleagues, and grow professionally. In addition, we are here to broaden our horizons and reach beyond ourselves, beyond our institutions, beyond our borders, if you will, to work with others to move our profession forward. We have just heard from two people who are working to do just that. Let us take these messages to heart and take advantage of the wealth of educational offerings at this annual meeting. Enjoy and learn. Thank you.